you know, the big issues with the economy today. And then after we talk about that, let's talk about how the press covers them.
Okay, well, there's obviously the economy's in bad shape. I mean, we may or may not technically be in a recession at this point, but we're in a period of considerably higher unemployment than we had before. We had 4% back in 2000. We're looking at around 6%. The economy continues to shed jobs. People are finding it a hard time to get reemployed. So we have very, very high rates of long-term unemployment. And the growth has been very, very slow, if positive. It's been very slow. So it's clearly a bad economic picture. The question is, how do we get here? Why are we here? There's a story. I'm no fan of Bush, as I think will be evident to everyone if it isn't already. But there's a story that a lot of Democrats like to tell that, you know, we had a great economy in 2000. We had this huge surplus. President Bush came into office, gave tax cuts oriented towards the rich, increased the military budget. We now have big deficits. The economy plummeted. It's perhaps a good political story. The reality is very different. The 90s was driven by a set of bubbles, first and foremost the stock market bubble, and I say this as someone who was talking about the time, so it's not 2020 hindsight. We had a stock bubble that led to a investment boom, particularly in the tech sectors, but, you know, economy-wide. Also, the stock market bubble led to a consumption boom. People thought they had, you know, hundreds of thousands in their 401ks, or at least some people did, and that disappeared. But they were spending like crazy when they thought they had all this money there. So that was really the driving force behind the boom of the 90s. And that gave out, and that was the immediate cause of the recession, primarily a fall off in investment in the wake of the stock crash. And that was an unusual period because typically the stock market doesn't finance much investment, but in 99, 2000 it was, when you can get IPOs, raise billions of dollars for tech companies that may never make a profit. That was financing investment. That was unusual. But the other part of the story, and what people haven't really focused on, is that that was only one of the three bubbles. The other two, the dollar bubble may start to be unwinding. We had the dollar hitting levels that were clearly unsustainable. It rose by 20 to 30% against the other major currencies.
Dean, let me just interrupt for 1 second. For our listeners who aren't economists, and you hear about the sort of dollar, what does it mean when the dollar is valued high, or you know, why was that a bubble?
Okay, well, the dollar is traded every day or every minute of every day in international financial markets. There's one in New York, London, Hong Kong. You know, most of the major financial centers have currency markets, and it's constantly being traded against the euro, against the British pound, against the other major currencies. And what happened in the late 90s, particularly beginning in 97 with the East Asian financial crisis, but on through 98, 99, 2000, the dollar rose against these other currencies. And what that does is it makes it very cheap for us to buy goods from these countries. If the dollar buys 20% more euros, other things equal, it costs me 20% less in dollars to buy a car made in Europe, to buy a Volkswagen or a BMW or whatever car I might be looking to get from Europe. Same is true with clothes from China or shoes from, you know, from East Asia, whatever it might be. So when the dollar rose in value in the late 90s, it made imports very, very cheap for people in the United States. Same time, the exact opposite happens with our exports. Suddenly, the goods we look to export to the rest of the world became very expensive because it's more costly for people living in Europe or China, wherever it might be, to acquire dollars. So long and short of that is our imports soared during this period, our exports plummeted, and we developed trade deficits that currently are on the order of $450 billion a year. And that's simply not sustainable. We can't, in effect, what that means is we're importing more than we're exporting, and the way we pay for that is by selling off our assets. We're selling off our stock, our capital stock. To some extent, we have foreigners who buy government debt, buy up mortgages on our houses, which, you know, we could do for a year, 2 years, 3 years, but at some point that doesn't become tenable, and, you know, we simply run out of things to sell, or we start to run out of things to sell, and the dollar has to fall. And, you know, sort of the good story we could tell about the late 90s, that things were suddenly very cheap, all these imported goods are very cheap, goes in reverse. They become very expensive.
And that's where we're at now with the dollar? The dollar is collapsing, or is it, what's happening to the dollar?
We're starting to see that. It's falling against the euro in a big way. To some extent, it's falling against the Japanese yen. It's not falling against all the currencies. Some of them are pegged to the dollar, so it's not an easy story to tell. So, for example, the Chinese currency, which is obviously very big for U.S. trade with China, a big chunk of our trade, That's pegged to the dollar. So unless China's government makes a decision to change the value of its currency, that value will stay in place. But we are starting to see some unwinding with the dollar falling against the tradable currencies, which will in time, we haven't seen that much of this yet, but will in time make those imported goods more expensive to us. That will be the bad part of it. The good part of the story is that it will start to get our trade deficit down. But at least in the short term, the bigger effect is simply going to be that we'll be paying higher prices for imports.
Okay, and then the third bubble?
Third bubble is a housing bubble. And this one I actually hadn't paid a lot of attention to till Alan Greenspan last summer made a big point of saying there was no housing bubble. So I thought I'd do some research on it, get all the data I could and take a look at the story. And when you look at it, it's pretty hard to say there's not a housing bubble. Long and short, housing prices have risen by about 32-33 percentage points more than the overall rate of inflation over the last 7 years. And nothing like that has ever happened before.
Hmm.
So you go, okay, well, why is it that people suddenly are willing to pay so much more for homes than they had in the past? Again, this is above the rate of inflation. So it's not just, I know all prices are rising. This is more than all prices are rising. And, you go, okay, well, people suddenly fell in love with housing to the point that, they're willing to give up, spend less on clothes and medical care, their kids' education. It's possible. It doesn't seem likely to me. The other likely story is that we have exactly what we had in Japan back in the late 80s, a real estate bubble coinciding with the stock bubble, that people make a lot of money in the stock market. They start to throw some of that into housing, thinking, why don't I get a bigger home, nicer home, whatever it might be. And that starts to drive up property values. Then people see the property values rising, so they go, well, property values are rising 10%, 20% a year, which they were in some of the, particularly hard-hit areas, the Seattle area, the Silicon Valley, here in D.C., Boston, Long Island. So they think, well, property values only go up. Why don't I just get a bigger home, get a second home? So we've seen a lot of that. People are throwing a lot of money into the real estate market thinking that housing prices are just going to keep going up. And in a lot of cases, people have borrowed a lot of money to get bigger homes than, they could probably afford. And they think they'll be fine because they're expecting, in 5 years that the place will sell for 20, 30, 40% more. And that would have been true if they bought the place 5 years ago. But for those buying it today, a lot of them are likely to be in for a rude surprise.
So what do you think? I mean, we've got one bubble has already burst, the stock market. The dollar bubble is in the process of bursting, albeit maybe not overnight, but slowly. Housing market is going to face, in your view, a burst soon in its bubble. What is this? What's the problem here? You say the economy is going from bad to worse. What do you anticipate we should be expecting then in the next year or two?
Well, when the housing bubble goes, the housing sector has been the one sector that's really sustained the economy the last couple of years. It accounts for housing directly. If you just look at home building, that accounts for about 5% of GDP, and that's been extremely strong. We've had pretty much record rates of construction 2002 into 2003, very, very high levels of home building. And that could well fall off 30 or 40%. That's not uncommon in a recession. And that will be a very, very big hit to the economy directly, just that fall off in home construction. Mm. But that's only part of the story. The other part of the story is that you have people borrowing against their homes. The big story, this has been widely reported, it's not a secret area, refinancing. Anyone who has a mortgage, you'd be crazy not to try and refinance. And, the one hand, a lot of people are doing that just out of, prudence, that, you have 20 years left on your mortgage, 15 years left on your mortgage, why not get a lower interest rate? But a lot of people have been cashing out, so they take advantage of the fact that their home has gone up in value, so maybe they had a $150,000 mortgage. They, instead of repaying part of it, they say, why not take out a $200,000 mortgage and use the extra money to, buy a new car or engage in other types of consumption. Sometimes they're just pressed. I don't mean to disparage these people. A lot of people are very badly pressed, so, if they can borrow against their home, that's what they're going to do. So in any case, you have a lot of people that are very heavily indebted. And if you get a burst of the bubble, you'll both have an end to this cycle that they won't be able to go back and refinance to sustain new consumption. But you also have a potential problem for the financial system where you may have a lot of people that have, let's say, $200,000 borrowed on a home that maybe today is worth $220,000, but if we see a big fall off in housing values, may only be worth, $160,000. So you'll actually have a mortgage that exceeds the value of the house. And the obvious story there is if I owe $200,000 on a home that's worth $160,000, well, give it to the bank. Let them worry about it. So that creates a very, very dangerous situation for the financial system, in addition, obviously, to a huge burden for a lot of people who will find themselves, you know, tremendously heavily indebted relative to their assets.
So in the short term or medium, in the coming year or so, there's a real threat that the economy could go into, as good a chance it could go back into recession or into some sort of stagnation or remain in stagnation rather than go into an upswing.
You know, if the housing bubble bursts, and I do think that's fairly likely for two reasons. One is we have record high rental vacancy rates, and those markets do feed off of each other. You know, if people can't rent, then they lower their rental fees, and people might otherwise own decide to rent. And alternatively, people have rental units to vacant, you know, they don't want to sit there and collect no rent. They look to sell them, convert them into ownership units. So that's one reason why I think it's the bursting the bubble might not be far in the future. The other one is that if anything pushes up mortgage interest rates, and one of those things could be some inflation triggered by a fall in the dollar, the boom will come to an end very quickly. And I don't mean, you know, mortgage interest rates don't have to go through the roof, but, you know, today they're at record lows, 5.45. Suppose they went up to something like 6.8%, which would still be historically a relatively low rate. I think that'd be enough to burst the bubble very quickly.
We're talking to Dean Baker today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so we are taking phone calls. And believe it or not, we're still a media show. We're not just a show on the economy, but today we're talking about how the media covers the economy. And Dean Baker writes a weekly column on that topic for TomPaine.com. It's called The Economic Reporting Review, where he reviews all the economic journalism. And we're going to be talking about that for much of this hour. If you'd like to call in and ask a question to Dean Baker, I can assure you there's very few areas he can't speak about with some authority concerning the economy and the media. The number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Indeed, I'd like to ask you one more question before we turn to the media coverage of the economy, because you alluded a few minutes ago to Japan and the similarities between the U.S. economy today, the situation we're in with the housing market and the stock market bubble, and Japan in the late 1980s, as I recall well, and I think many of our listeners will, up until around 1988 or 1989, when Japan's economy was mentioned in the United States throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was regarded as an economy that was absolutely extraordinary, growing at rates that were the envy of the world, and that it was going to be the dominant capitalist power in the world within a generation. I think that was the consensus, at least among many people in the United States, if not worldwide, in the 1980s. The past 10 or 15 years, Japan has entered into a period of prolonged deep stagnation. And, you know, it has sort of turned around. It's been an extraordinary turnaround. And many people say the United States may well be facing what Japan faced. Could you talk about that?
This might get back to the issue of coverage before you had intended, but, you know, people tend to exaggerate on all sides, and what happens is you have everyone saying what everyone else says. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, Japan's economy did appear to be doing very well. And we should give Japan an awful lot of credit in, you know, their economic performance, in the sense that if you go back to the 50s, it was a very poor country. And, you know, in the span of 35 years, it moved itself right up into the middle of, you know, the industrialized nations in terms of, you know, the standard of living of its population. It's quite an impressive achievement. You can point to many countries that have achieved similar progress. So in that sense, that was real. That wasn't just an illusion. There was quite a strong economic performance. But, you know, after that, they've had essentially, you know, 14, 15 years of stagnation since their bubbles burst. And, you know, basically the bubbles were concealing a lot of problems. And, you know, I think the same was true in the United States, that we had this great celebration around the new economy in 98, 99, 2000. People just couldn't say enough good things about it. And there were real problems there for people who cared to look. But, you know, you couldn't get most of the media to talk about that. They just wanted to say, well, stock market hit another high again this week. And, you know, that was the extent to which they were willing to look at the economy. So, you know, will we go to 10 or 15 years of stagnation? We don't have to. I would say Japan didn't have to. I mean, Japan should be instructive in the sense that if you do everything wrong, that's what you can get. And, you know, will we do everything wrong in the United States? I don't know. I mean, the one thing I will say, and I'll give Alan Greenspan a lot of credit here, he was very, very quick, much quicker than I would have thought, you know, in advance, in responding to the downturn in 2001, and the fact that we're sitting here today with the federal funds rate, the interest rate that's most directly under the Federal Reserve Board's control, at 1.25%, I never would have thought we'd see that day. I mean, mm-hmm. So he lowered interest rates very, very quickly, which was the right thing to do, something they didn't do in Japan, at least not quickly enough. So that was a very positive step. It's not enough, but we would have been much worse off if we had been sitting here, say, with an interest rate of 3%, 3.5%, which, if you know, we were having the show 2 years ago, that's, you know, those are the numbers I would have thrown out.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dean Baker today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dean Baker is a macroeconomist and the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. We're talking about the press coverage of the economy. We'll be talking about the Bush tax cuts, the corporate scandals, the coverage of Social Security, the war in Iraq in the next 40 minutes. We welcome your phone calls. The number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 800-222-9455, and we have some callers. So let's go right to the phone lines, Dean.
Okay.
Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Yeah, well, I'm eager to hear what you're going to say about the media and covering the economy. I just heard somebody on CNN the other night that seemed pretty poor by the names of Dobbs. But anyway, also I'm hoping maybe you'll tell us what newspapers or websites one might go to for good economic news. But I'm also interested in, you know, if people don't have an education about the economy, how can they understand the media if it would decide to talk intelligently, you know, about the economy? So I don't know if you think about that. But and that has to do with, you know, when one teaches students about international politics or, you know, things that are going on in the world, they don't really seem to have any idea of how the United States might be connected to other countries. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, connections between the economy, politics, war, and things of that nature, or, you know, how would some people in the world see the World Trade Center as very symbolic and use it as a target, not to justify that at any yeah. on any level.
All right. Thank you, Colin.
Well, you gave me a lot of things to cover there.
Yeah, I'll say.
Well, let me try and chop off a few of those.
Well, why don't you start with her? You know, she said she saw Lou Dobbs, the business editor on CNN, and she apparently wasn't too impressed with Mr. Dobbs. Maybe your general critique of what passes for business journalism or coverage of the economy in the mainstream news media. Just a few words you can say about that to start with.
Yeah. One is it's hugely oriented towards the financial industry, and this is something I've written about frequently in the Economic Reporting Review. It's very common for reporters just to talk about an economic issue exclusively from the perspective of how it affects financial markets, how it affects the stock market. Talk to people at Merrill Lynch, you know, an economist or an analyst at Merrill Lynch and Citigroup, and you know, sometimes I frequently will comment on that. I'll just go, here are the four sources for the story, and all four of them are for the financial industry, and.
You what's just, wrong with that?
Well, the financial industry has a very particular perspective, you know. So, you know, the analogy I like to make is imagine that they had four sources and they all came from labor unions. I mean, we'd never see that, and we shouldn't. I mean, that's, you know, it'd be inappropriate to have a story on the economy where all your sources are coming from labor unions. Financial industry is concerned first and foremost. They don't want to see inflation. You know, they're concerned about bondholders who might lose the value of their wealth if there's a lot of inflation. That's their overwhelming concern. It's a very, very narrow perspective. They might be willing to live with a lot of unemployment, whereas, you know, most people get most of their income from their jobs. The concern about unemployment will be much, much greater than, you know, maybe the inflation rate will be half or one percentage point higher this year than otherwise would have been. So it's a very narrow perspective. It just seems sort of very basic that, mm-hmm. you know, you'd want at the very least, my God, at least go to General Motors, talk to someone from another industry, you know, yeah. if not getting someone from government, labor, you know, nonprofit, wherever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Second point is, and this has just been amazing to me, and this is just, I've really gotten upset with a number of reporters, the stock market's not the economy. And a rising stock market is not necessarily good. It's, you know, the analogy I like to make, it's like a higher price of oil. Well, if you're an oil producer, of course, you're very happy that oil prices are higher. But why should anyone else be happier? And the media routinely report as good news. You know, the marketplace on public radio, they play happy music when the stock market's up. Well, if you own a lot of stock, that's good news. But, you know, if stock prices are up either because, you know, wages are down, you know, corporate profits are up at the expense of wages, well, most people get most of their money from wages. That's not good news for them. Alternatively, if stock prices are up simply because we're in a bubble and it's gotten further inflated, that's not good news either. So, you know, this equation of the stock market with the economy is just really pernicious. And,
mm-hmm.
It's not even an ideological issue. I mean, I could sit down with the most conservative economist and just say, you know, I know you might own a lot of stock, you might like people who own a lot of stock, but can you tell me that's good news for the economy as a whole that, let's say, the stock market goes up? No one would tell me it is. But yet it's routinely reported that way.
Where would you go? Where do you get your news information? Where would you tell people to go besides going to your commentary on TomPaine.com every week? What are the places to really, for people who want to really get a critical analysis of the economy that doesn't approach it just from the perspective of investors or bondholders?
I wish I could say a lot of places. I mean, you really have to look around. I mean, there are good reporters even in the mainstream media. You know, the New York Times has some very good reporters. You know, just to mention a few, David K. Johnston does great work on taxes. Gretchen Morgenson, who's done some great work in investigating corporate corruption. Lou Chattel is a very good reporter on general economic issues. So there are some good reporters at the New York Times, you know, some decent reporters at the Wall Street Journal. But you really have to poke around. You know, I should mention one, Warren Veith, the LA Times. I read his stuff frequently. But, you know, someone really has to poke around, helps to look at the foreign press. The BBC often will have good coverage of issues. But there's not, I really can't recommend a single place that someone could look to, you know, and regularly count on getting good economic reporting.
We're talking to Dean Baker, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dean Baker is an economist, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, and the author of many books and articles, and we'll be talking, I hope, later about his book on Social Security. The number here, if you'd like to call in and ask Dean Baker a question, is 333-9455, our toll-free number, and the toll-free line is open now, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the very patient people who have been waiting. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask just about credit card debt. It seems like a lot of Americans carry a lot of credit card debt as well, and I, in my opinion, and I'm not anywhere near an economist or anything, but I could see how that could create a bubble that could really burst. And I just wanted to hear your opinion on this.
Yeah, I think it's very great grounds for concern, because the flip side, when I was saying a moment ago how consumption was soaring in the late 90s because of the stock bubble, you know, people were spending money because they had all this money in the stock market. Part of that story was they were borrowing in many cases, and often borrowing on their credit card. And credit card debt relative to income is at a record high now. It had hit a very high level in 1990, and a lot of people were concerned about it then. At that point, it was about mixing credit card and car debt together, because we usually look at those numbers together. But at that point, it was about the two together around 19.5% of disposable income. Today, it'd be around 24% of disposable income. So it's at a very high level. Some of it, you know, people get careless, but a lot of it is people, when they're pressed, that's an easy loan to get. If you have a line of credit on your credit card, that's the easiest loan to get. So you have a lot of people that, you know, they're meeting their day-to-day bills by borrowing against their credit card, and, you know, you can do that for a period of time, but when you're paying 18% interest, is often the case, it becomes hard to sustain. So I worry about that, and, you know, the flip side of it, personal bankruptcies are at record high levels. So, you know, that's the flip side. We're seeing it already, and it's likely to get worse.
Now, Dean, if I can just follow up on that, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, personal debt, corporate or private sector, business debt, and now government debt recently, but the first two in particular, rose dramatically, have risen dramatically in the past couple of decades, play a much larger role in the economy. Is that true? And if that's true, is that something we should be concerned about?
Yeah, we certainly should. Personal debt, basically in the 80s, you saw a very big rise in corporate debt. It fell off into the early 90s as you had a restoration of profitability coming out of the recession, then began to increase in the late 90s and last year or two. Consumer debt, which is the one that worries me more because, you know, this is, you know, people's lives most immediately, and that rose a great deal in the 80s and continued to rise in the 90s. And one of the things that I always point out to people are our numbers aren't perfectly comparable through time, because you have a lot of people that buy cars today or have cars on leasing arrangements, which for all practical purposes are substitutes for car debt. And somewhere in the order of 1 in 4 cars is now leased, new cars is now leased. So that's an effect. I mean, if you want to make the numbers comparable, you'd have to add 1.5, 2 percentage points to the consumer debt burden. Plus, people have much less equity in their home than they have historically. We should given the aging of the baby boomers, given the run-up in housing prices, we would expect that, you know, the equity-to-value ratio, you know, what percent of your house do you actually own, we'd expect that to be at pretty much record highs. Mm-hmm. And it's the opposite. It's at a post-war low.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a lot to worry about with the debt. We have a lot to worry about that, you know, we'll get to Social Security, but I look at the private side, you know, we have all these baby boomers in their 40s and many well into their 50s now who don't have that many more years in the workforce. They have very little saved, and in many cases they have large debt, and they're not going to have much to support themselves when they retire.
We're talking to Dean Baker today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are all full for the local calls. We're going to get to all of you. Please be patient. The number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, pick up on something you mentioned about the housing bubble and the possibility of bursting it, which brings up a couple questions for me. One is they've been talking about the specter of deflation lately, and Greenspan's been warning us about it. Well, I'm wondering, does that mean that, does he see the possibility of, or the option of increasing interest rates as a way of stopping deflation, connecting it to what you had said, if they increase interest rates, they might, you know, deliberately burst or inadvertently burst the housing bubble, which might collapse everything? And could you talk in general about just how bad is deflation versus inflation? I find it hard to figure out who might be giving us the straight scoop on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, let me just start with the housing bubble. And this may sound perverse to people, but if I had my choice, I would burst it tomorrow. Because it's the exact same thing with the stock bubble. You're having every day that we have housing at inflated prices, you're getting people buying homes that may be overvalued in some cases by 30, 40, 50%. So it would be more harmful to the economy if it happens, you know, tomorrow than if it doesn't happen tomorrow. But on the other hand, if it happens tomorrow as compared to happening, you know, a year, 2, 3 years from now when housing prices are even more inflated, we'll be worse off at that point. So I would like to see that bubble deflate quickly. I think the sooner the better. It's a bad story, but it just gets worse if it happens later. So I don't. I would not be trying to, you know, if I were sitting in on Greenspan's shoes, I would not be praying that the bubble doesn't deflate. He'll get blamed for it, and he deserves it. But you know, but the sooner the better. Now the issue of deflation. This has been, you know, I think widely misrepresented, but you know, it's come to be sort of this horror story, and it could be bad news. But there's nothing magic about zero. I mean, I kept encountering this with the balanced budget. We have to have balance of budget. Like zero was something we should worship, or people used to talk about having zero inflation, like that was, you know, the golden, you know, rule that we wanted zero inflation. But, you know, going from zero to negative isn't any worse in many ways than going from 2% inflation to 1% inflation or 1% inflation to 0%. When people borrow money, they're expecting a certain rate of inflation. The most obvious example we're all familiar, most of us would be familiar with, is with a mortgage. You expect, you know, if you borrow at, let's say, 7% on your mortgage, there's an expectation that your home's going to go up in value, let's say, 3% a year, which would have been more or less normal over the last 30, 40, 50 years, sometimes more rapidly than that, sometimes a little less, but that'd be, you know, somewhere in the ballpark. If instead your home doesn't rise in value at all, so instead of having 3% inflation in housing prices, you have zero, you're suddenly, in effect, paying a much higher rate of interest on your home, on your mortgage, in effect, paying a 7% rate rather than what you thought to be a 4%, 7% nominal rate minus the 3% inflation. So the fact that the inflation rate fell below what you had anticipated hurts you. And now let's flip that over, and let's say we started 5, and instead of we'd been expecting 1, instead it ends up being minus 1. It's the same sort of story. So there's no real magic to the zero here. Now, what people have emphasized, and this is something I've written about a number of times in the Economic Reporting Review, is that there is a floor in interest rates. So if I'm Alan Greenspan, I'm going to want to boost the economy by lowering interest rates. Well, he's got the rate he controls down to 1.25. He can go to zero. He can't go any further. He can't have a negative interest rate. He can't, in effect, require people to pay him to hold money, you know, so he can't have a negative interest rate. So there is a floor of zero. That's a concern, but the more important issue is what happens with the longer-term interest rates, because the short-term interest rate does have an effect on the economy, but the more important effect is what goes on with the 10-year rate, the 30-year rate, you know, the rates that we pay on mortgages, the rate that corporations pay to borrow for 10 years or 30 years when they want to issue new debt to finance investment. And that's likely to have a floor well above zero. And what's happened as Greenspan has lowered interest rates is that the long-term rates have, I wouldn't say completely stopped falling, but they don't fall very much. And one reason that Greenspan's reluctant, I mean, you know, sort of an obvious thing to say, okay, you know, the economy's still going very slow, we're concerned about deflation, why don't we try to stimulate the economy by lowering rates further? He knows that, you know, he could lower it from 1.25 to, you know, let's say 0.25. It's not clear that that would have a significant effect in lowering the mortgage rate that people pay or lowering the corporate bond rate. So we're already experiencing the problems associated with a low interest rate or low inflation rate even before the inflation rate turns negative.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not really this magic about deflation, and I think the coverage has been irresponsible in playing it up like, oh my God, if it turns negative, that would be a disaster.
Dean, let me if I can interrupt you for 1 second, because you talked about stimulating the economy, using interest rates to do that by spurring investment. I mean, one of the huge stories, and one I really want to talk about before we get back to the other callers, and you've written about it, is the Bush tax cuts, enormous tax cuts that the claim is will put money in the hands of people so they can spend it and will drive economic growth. Could you just give us your assessment of that, please?
Yeah, I mean, Bush has gotten away with this, you know, in the media, and just really it's almost been a crime. I mean, you could tell two stories in tax cuts. One is that you're going to cut taxes, have them oriented towards people who are going to spend it, and you hope that will stimulate demand. It's sort of a traditional Keynesian story that's usually been the rationale for tax cuts. You know, when Kennedy had them in the 60s, they always refer to that. There are tax cuts in the 74 recession with the same motive. You want to give people money, you hope they'll spend it. Alternative story you could tell is that you're going to give people money and you don't hope they spend it. You hope they save it. You know, this is the justification of the supply side story. And that's the typical rationale as to why you might have a tax cut oriented towards rich people. You're hoping they don't spend it. You want to give them incentive to save it. Now, what Bush has managed to do is have his tax cut described both ways. On the one hand, he's saying, oh, it's going to stimulate the economy. We're going to increase spending. But then at the same time, he's saying, well, it's going to spur investment and savings, you know, long-term growth. And those two are antithetical. You could examine the evidence. And the evidence is people do spend at least some of it, so it won't increase savings. It won't increase growth in the long-term sense that Bush has claimed. That's the evidence on that. And the vast majority of economists, I think, would agree on that. But you surely can't have it both ways, and in the media coverage of it, they've allowed Bush to have it both ways, that on the one hand, he'll have this tax cut, it's going to be this great short-term stimulus, and then also somehow people are saving it, and that's going to have this long-term benefit to growth.
You know, it's been a while since I took my economics courses, but as I understand it, if you want to have a tax cut that will stimulate consumption and immediate spending, you give it to people who will spend the money, and the poorer the people are, the more likely they are to spend it.
Yeah, that's just common sense.
Yeah.
You know, we give another $1,000 to Bill Gates. I don't think it's going to affect his spending very much.
Yeah, and so these tax cuts, as I understand them, are heavily weighted towards the upper income brackets. So we would not expect them then to have necessarily much of an immediate stimulative effect in the economy.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, they're designed very much towards the upper end. I mean, if you look at the dividend tax cut, it's almost exclusively, you know, people in the top 10% they're going to get that. And a lot of people, I've actually been amazed by this, a lot of people don't even realize that they're not going to get it because you do have more middle-income people that have 401ks. I have a 401k. I'm not sure if I have any stock in there, but let's say I did. This doesn't help me at all because, you know, when I take the money out of the 401k, I'm still going to pay tax on it just as I do now. So there's a lot of people, I think they realize that they're not even going to benefit from this tax cut. You're only going to benefit from it if you hold stock outside of retirement accounts.
Now, this tax cut is going to, I mean, it's an enormous tax cut. Could it have, what sort of effects might it have on the economy? What sort of stories aren't being covered or are being covered that people should be aware of?
Well, it will have a small stimulative effect. You know, he's not entirely wrong to claim there'll be a stimulative effect. That's for two reasons. One is that some of it is a more middle-class tax cut. He has this tax cut for the child tax credit goes from $600 to $1,000. So there are people who earn $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year who will get a $400 per child tax credit. You know, so that's something. It's not huge in terms of the whole economy. That's something. Also, some of the dividend tax cut will be spent, not a huge percentage of it, but some of it. So you will see some boost. It will increase the deficit, but it will give some economic boost. So that'll be a positive side. I don't think it'll be that large, but some positive side. The negative side is it clearly leads to a larger deficit, and you know, you're familiar with my writing on this. I'm the last person to whine about deficits, but they can get too large, and these are too large. We are looking at very large deficits now. So, you know, I think the Democrats went overboard in saying, you know, we have to pay down the debt. We always have to balance the budget without the Social Security surplus. That was just silly, irresponsible. But, you know, we're looking at deficits now that for this year it's going to be well over $400 billion if we get this tax cut through. Next year, pretty comparable size. And, you know, we really can't afford deficits of that order, at least not for any significant period of time. So, you know, these are very large tax cuts. The deficits of that size will force some change, whether it's on the spending side or tax side down the road. You know,
so governments will have a lot less money to spend for social services.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And the crisis that our state governments are feeling all across the country right now will get worse in all likelihood.
Yeah, and that's the other really important point, that if we're looking to stimulate the economy, the most obvious and sure way to do it is let's give the money to the state and local governments so they don't have to make the cutbacks, because here we are at the federal level trying to stimulate the economy, and the states are going the exact opposite direction. They're raising taxes, cutting spending. You know, we'll be lucky if on net that ends up even being positive. It'll probably be negative because the state-level cutbacks will probably be larger than the stimulus created by the tax cut.
In these sort of issues that we've been talking about, I mean, generally speaking, can people get a sense of this, do you think, from watching CNN or NBC News or Fox News? How well are these stories covered, the tax cut, which is really a central issue of economic issue of our times?
Horribly. I mean, the tax, I mean, one of the complaints, and this would be true of the coverage of the Clinton administration as well, but one of the complaints I have of the economic reporting is they let the issues be entirely framed by the administration. So it's constantly put, you know, do you support growth, a tax package that will lead to growth, or are you more concerned about the deficit and equity?
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost no evidence this tax cut will lead to growth. I shouldn't say almost. There is no evidence.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
The Congressional Budget Office, which, you know, is usually, they make mistakes, but I think they try to be reasonably fair, and it's headed now by a former Bush advisor who just left the administration to head up the Congressional Budget Office, and a believer in supply-side economics. He believes in this stuff. They ran a series of projections using a number of different models, and the only models that found that this led to any growth at all, and even that was very modest, but the only ones that found this led to any increase in growth at all were models where they had this very sort of artificial assumption that we said, okay, we're going to assume the tax cuts in place for 10 years, the projection period, and then after that we have tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
So after 2013 or 14, the last year in the model, we're all looking at higher taxes. So when you put that assumption into the model, what happens is everyone goes, okay, well, I know after 2014 I'll be paying higher taxes, so why don't I make a big point of working real hard over the next decade?
Mm-hmm.
And then I slough off. I mean, this is all kind of silly, but I mean,
yeah.
But if you imagine that, you know, that makes sense. But you know, that's not no one would support a tax cut based on that.
We're talking to Dean Baker today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have two very patient callers who've been waiting. Let's get to them right now. Line 3, Charleston, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
I had two questions, actually, both about the tax cut. One of the big arguments that's been made in favor of the dividend tax cut is that taxing dividends is double taxation because corporations are taxed on their profits and then the dividend recipients are taxed on the dividends. I just wondered whether you thought that argument had any philosophical or economic merit, and more generally, what would be the correct way to handle corporate taxes and dividend taxes. And my second question relates to an article that Joseph Stiglitz wrote a couple of months ago in the New York Review of Books. I don't know if you read it, but he claimed that one of the reasons that the tax cut won't lead to any growth in the economy is because there's still overcapacity in the productive sector due to the bubble, and so none of the people, you know, no investors with money have any incentive to invest in any kind of capacity. So anyway, I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say about the
Really excellent questions. Dean Baker, fire.
Yeah, great. I love that first one. Because the double taxation issue here, too, this is just incredibly a case of incredibly bad reporting by the media. They've routinely used this phrase, double taxation, which comes from the Bush administration. They're proponents of the tax cut. What do you want to say? You know, dividend tax is bad. It's double taxation. Just like they didn't like the estate tax, they start calling it the death tax. Now, it would have been completely irresponsible for the media to start referring to it as the death tax, and in general, they did not. But they have picked up this double taxation. Now, it's not double taxation.
Just for our listeners who are not dividend receivers and don't pay taxes in dividends, what is this double taxation stuff all about?
Okay, I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Here's the story as to why they'd say it's double taxation. Corporations pay a corporate income tax. So General Motors, General Electric, whoever it might be, they pay a corporate income tax that in principle is about 35% of their profits for large corporations, most corporations. They have a lot of loopholes and everything, but in principle, if they're paying their tax as they should, it would be 35%. Then, from corporate profits, they pay money in dividends to shareholders, who then are subject to tax on their dividend income, just like, you know, a teacher or firefighter is subject to tax on their wages. So the argument is this money's been taxed twice. It's been taxed at the corporate level. Then, when the corporation paid it out to the individual, it's been taxed at the individual level. Now, the reason why I would say this is completely bogus is a corporation's a separate entity. This is something the conservatives have argued for. It's really important, they say, that corporations have the right for free speech. They could sue and be sued. They're separate actors. There's all sorts of privileges associated with a corporate entity. You know, first and foremost, limited liability. We could have a corporation that dumps toxic chemicals into a lake and, you know, pollutes drinking water for people, damages their health, their kids' health. And, you know, at the end of the day, you could sue the corporation, but if the corporation doesn't have any assets, you're out of luck. You can't go to the shareholders. That's a privilege that the government gives to corporations. Okay, so it's very important that corporations are not individuals. This is what the conservatives have argued for, not people on the left. That's what they've argued for. Now what they're telling us is, no, corporations really are nothing more than those individuals. And to my mind, this is really outrageous because, you know, again, just being, you know, applying good economic analysis to this, we know that every single shareholder values the corporate the privileges associated with the corporation at least as much as the 35% tax that they have to pay or that the corporation has to pay. Otherwise, they wouldn't hold the share. So the government is giving something of enormous value to corporations. They're allowing them to establish themselves as legal entities. General Motors is not just me and another, you know, 100,000 or whatever number of stockholders. It's a separate legal entity completely apart from me. That's a privilege that the government gives to General Motors, and that's tremendously valuable. Otherwise, we wouldn't hold the stock. We just have a partnership. We don't have to have a corporation. So it's not double taxation. It's a totally separate entity, and it's a complete myth that this is somehow some unfair treatment. It would be quite unfair the opposite way. In effect, what that means is we want the government to give the corporation something or give people something for nothing, and I just can't see any justification for that. Now, in terms of the economic merits, I mean, that's sort of the philosophical moral issue. The economic merits, one of the things that got a really big kick out of Reagan back in 1986, we had a tax reform that he embraced. It came out of Congress, but he enthusiastically embraced it. And what it did was it lowered tax rates, but it taxed all income the same. It lowered some tax rates. It raised the tax rates on capital gains and some other types of income. And he made a big speech where he said, this is great because now we're going to eliminate, you'll no longer be making profits or money from the tax code. You'll have to make it by earning it. And there's a real logic to that. You want income to be taxed the same way so you don't have incentive to hide wage income as capital gains or as this would indicate as dividend income. When we make, if we have, as Bush wants, zero tax on dividend income, there's a tremendous incentive for people in a position to do so to hide their income as dividend income. So not only is this not likely to help the economy, getting back to Stiglitz's point, it's very hard to see how this would really spur any investment anytime soon. It's going to create a whole new growth in the tax shelter industry since you'll have a lot of very clever people who are going to figure out how top executives of corporations could hide their wage income as dividend income and then not have to pay any taxes on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then how about the second part of the question regarding Joe Stiglitz's recent article that global overcapacity means that there's very little incentive to do new investment when wealthy people are given these enormous tax breaks since there's already so much capacity. It'd be absurd to build more factories.
Yeah, you have in the United States, our capacity utilization is under 75%. It's just about the lowest it's been in the post-war period. And, you know, you can give people a lot of tax breaks, but it doesn't make sense to build a factory, a new factory, if the existing one is already, you know, one quarter idle. So, you know, he's exactly right on that score. I mean, you have to have the increase in demand come from some other source right now. And, you know, giving more tax breaks to the rich just won't do it. That just, you can give them more incentives, but that it doesn't make any sense.
We're talking to Dean Baker today on Media Matters. We've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. We've got a couple callers I plan to get to in just 1 second. We probably could squeeze in another call at 333-9455 if someone did want to try to get on the air. Dean Baker writes a weekly column called The Economic Reporting Review at www.tompaine.com. He's the author of lots of articles. And you wrote a wonderful book on Social Security with Mark Weisbrot, who's a recent guest on the show. What was the name of that book?
The Phony Crisis.
The Phony Crisis. And basically your argument there, just in a nutshell before we get back to the phone lines.
Well, that there's very little problems facing the Social Security system. We rely entirely on the Social Security Trustees Report, which is the standard source that everyone in the debate uses. And basically what that says is if we did absolutely nothing, the program could pay all benefits for 40 years, which is something we couldn't say at any point in the 40s, 50s, 60s, or 70s. So that's pretty good. And even if you look very out, very long into the future, 75 years, the projected shortfall is fairly modest, and we need no larger tax increase than what we had in any of those prior decades, you know, the 40s through the 80s, to make the fund fully solvent for, you know, its entire 75-year projection period.
Yet at the same time, the press coverage of this story of Social Security is one routinely of a system in severe crisis that needs to be radically reformed or else it'll go bankrupt.
Yeah, and here's a case again where they just, you know, picked up the line from the political parties, and, you know, I've argued with these people because we shoved the book in front of their face and we go, what numbers are you referring to? And, you know, the Republicans have argued this case because they want to privatize the system, and the Democrats have argued this case because it became convenient that this was their little jujitsu here in the late 90s when, you know, suddenly we had the large surpluses instead of deficits. President Clinton in 98 said, well, we have to save Social Security first rather than have a tax cut. So they thought that was a clever way to prevent a tax cut. As it turns out, we obviously got the tax cut, and, you know, it helped feed the view that Social Security was facing some, you know, insoluble crisis.
We're talking to Dean Baker. Let's go back to the phone line and get our last two callers who've been patiently waiting. Line two, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wasn't asked to make this call, but I wanted to ask about his most recent book and the whole idea of this reserve currency. Most of the time it's framed in, will it go over to euros rather than dollars? I'd like to see somebody make the argument that this is one of the most anti-development things for the, you know, it's enforcing these. You can describe it better than me, but the whole idea that it's seen as whether the dollar is going to fall or not. What about seeing whether it's idling resources that could be actually bettering the lives of many people in the world?
Yeah, a very good question. We wrote a paper a year or two back called Money for Nothing, and it was about how developing nations have felt the need to acquire vast amounts of foreign exchange reserves. And most of this is dollars, of course, and they're holding this money at very, very low returns, basically zero real interest, instead of using it to build up their infrastructure, provide education or health care for their people. And, you know, this is a function of the instability in the international financial system. And, you know, everyone's terrified that they'll see another crisis like, you know, the East Asian financial crisis in 97. So, you know, it's a huge cost to people in developing nations. And, you know, to my mind, if you want a simple measure that sort of just shows the failure of the international financial system, the amount of reserves that developing nations are forced to hold is, you know, probably that measure.
Okay, well, let's go back to our final caller then right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi, Dean Baker. I'm curious, what percentage of the taxes are paid by the highest income groups? Like, if you're making $30,000 a year and you're in that group, how much do you personally actually contribute? Because it's my theory that if you're poor, you don't pay that much taxes, and there's not that much to give back.
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, there's gotten to a lot of nonsense semantics over what counts as a tax, and to my mind, I don't really care. I mean, you know, if you don't count Social Security and Medicare as a tax, then if you just say income tax, I mean, I don't care about playing shell games or anything. The bulk of the income tax, individual income tax, certainly is paid by, say, the richest 20 or 30% of the population.
Don't they deserve the tax break? They're the ones contributing. Wouldn't it be great if the government had said, yeah, we'd like to have another military adventure in another country, but we just don't have the cash?
Well, the question is, does anyone deserve a tax break? Actually, to be honest, I don't know of ever a time where the government has felt that the lack of cash prevented from military action. If you look at World War II, we were having deficits on the order of 20-30% GDP. That would be on the order of $2 or $3 trillion these days. So if you're hoping that lack of cash is going to keep the government from engaging in military adventures, I think that's a rather vain hope. But, you know, in terms of a tax break, you know, the question, to my mind, the government doesn't just set taxes, it sets a whole structure of rewards for people, and we've pursued policies that have made it very easy for a small number of people to get incredibly rich and made it very difficult for most people to even get by. So the fact that we might take back some of the money that, you know, we've in effect allowed people like Bill Gates to get, the government gives him his copyright, you know, the government will arrest people who make copies of Windows. I don't have a big problem with saying, you know, if we make up a system that's going to let you get very, very rich, well, we're going to take some of that back in taxes to deal with some of the other problems that that's created.
Dean, we've only got a few seconds left. Just quickly, can you say a word about the cost of the Iraq War since the caller brought that up and, you know, what effect that might have on the economy?
Well, there's a lot of big uncertainties. I mean, they appropriated about $70 billion for that, which is large, but it's not devastating. The bigger consequences are going to be how much we spend down the road. What does this occupation look like? You know, are we going to see more acts of terrorism? Are we going to see oil fields hit, oil taken off the world market? Are we going to see retaliation against the United States elsewhere in the world? Perhaps people boycotting our products, which we probably already are seeing. So I think that the cost of the war, it's not trivial, but that in and of itself won't be that large. The bigger costs are going to be faced down the road.
Dean, you probably hear the band tuning up in the background. That means I've got to get out of here. Dean Baker, thank you so much for being our guest today in Media Matters.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Yep, and you can follow Dean Baker's work at tompaine.com on the Internet, his weekly column. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. We're going to be back in the next couple of weeks with Jenny Toomey and Christian Sandvik, and I would like very much to thank Kumi Silva in her first episode as Media Matters producer. See you next week, sir.